He is a journalist, a columnist, commentator, pundit, Pulitzer Prize winner, and I wanted to say polymath just to stick with the alliteration. George Will is joining us today, columnist for The Washington Post. He's a man you know, you may not love, but you might. And I'm hoping we get some calls from you folks this morning at 382-8255, 382-TALK. Also, you can email us at talk@stlpublicradio.org. Mr. Will, thanks for coming in today.
Glad to be with you.
You're going to be speaking at Washington University at Graham Chapel. The John C. Danforth Center on Religion and Politics presents George Will and Religion and Politics in the First Modern Nation. You can get more information about that, by the way, at 935-9345. Or get details on our website. You go to a lot of college campuses, I'm guessing.
Fair number.
Yeah. What are you hearing? We're going to talk about conservatism in America because that's really who you are. What are you seeing in college campuses today as opposed to, say, 10, 20, 30 years ago?
I think today there's a kind of libertarian impulse on campuses having to do with gay rights, having to do with legalization of marijuana. But also, and this is conservatism's challenge, is to expand this part of it, having to do with free markets and the sense that limited government serves progress.
What's the future then, do you think, for the party? Does the party adapt to that, or do these folks redefine the party on their own?
Well, the party has always been the natural home of libertarians who are against the expansion of the state. And for that reason, I think the prospects for the party with young voters is if not shimmering bright, at least promising.
You know, it is the John C. Danforth lecture. You know Jack Danforth, I'm sure. He's a well-respected figure in Missouri, in the United States. On election night, he was saying that the party has to worry about its brand now. We were specifically talking about the Todd Akin, Claire McCaskill race. He said, we can't just worry about winning a single election in this case. We have to worry about the brand. How would you phrase that? How would you interpret that?
Well, it is the case that one or two candidates making one or two egregious mistakes, not just Akin here in Missouri, but Murdoch running for the Senate seat in Indiana, making a similar mistake, can do brand damage to the brand nationally. But on the other hand, you don't want to overdo that. Every party has its eccentrics. The Democratic Party has its own share of them. So the brand is not defined by the outliers of a party. It's defined by the central leaders of the party. And the Republican Party at this moment has a very deep and attractive rising bench of younger competitors who will be the face of the party in the future. I mean, Mitt Romney did his best, came close, not good enough. But Mitt Romney will recede now, and there's no such thing as a Romney Republican. There used to be fights in the Republican Party, the Goldwater Republicans against the Rockefeller Republicans. You don't have that kind of fight anymore. And if someone said, are you a Romney Republican, people would be a little bit hard-pressed to define that.
Was that part of his issue or problem?
Well, that was part of his problem. His main problem was, two main problems. One is he came from finance at a moment when, after the Great Recession and too big to fail and Wall Street was in bad odor generally, that was not a good thing to be. But also he was not a natural politician. Wasn't his, he ran for the Senate in 92 and lost. Then in a decade later, he wins one term as governor of Massachusetts. That's a fairly limited electoral resume, and it showed.
He didn't really resonate, you think, with the voters the way he needed to?
No, I think a lot of people were enthusiastic for him because they wanted to beat the incumbent president.
Let's talk about the Republican base, because one of the things a party, whether it's the Democratic Party or I guess the Libertarians or the Republican Party, has to deal with, satisfy, build upon its base. What is the base of the Republican Party? Is it the Tea Party? Is it Christian conservatives? Those are the folks that are very often referred to as the base that you have to appeal to. Is that where the base of the Republican Party really is?
It's part of it. Any American party. This is a big country, a continental nation, with durable regional differences and a complicated social structure. The most remarkable coalition of the 20th century was Franklin Roosevelt's coalition. Southern segregationists, Northern intellectuals, organized labor, farmers. Four groups had very little to say to one another, except they rather liked to win, and so they cooperated with one another. So you can have, and indeed you have to have in this country, a base that consists of disparate elements. Democratic parties based today as minorities and public employees. And they will be, over time, particularly the public employees, are going to be a problem for the Democratic Party.
You talk about the wide range of people and views, I think, within the United States and within parties. Let's talk a little bit about religion, because I think the Christian conservatives are very often defined as religious America. And yet there are plenty of people out there who consider themselves to be in the religious center or the religious left or religious in such a way that it doesn't really influence their politics one way or the other. Are we missing the point about how important religion is to many Americans, and yet how maybe it's not the always the most important thing?
Well, I think that's right. A great many people can be very religious, and then you say, what do you vote on? And they say, well, I vote on jobs. I vote on the price of college tuitions and all the rest. The average Christian conservative votes the way the average American does in terms of the issues that move him or her. Now, they may wind up on the conservative side because they take a conservative interpretation of what's best for the economy.
So let me talk a little bit about your background. I'm not sure everybody's aware of the fact that everybody thinks maybe you're an Easterner originally. You're from Champaign, Illinois.
Champaign, Illinois. My father was a professor of philosophy at the university. I went east to go to school just because I didn't want to stay at home. I went to Trinity College in Hartford, then went to Oxford for 2 years, then got a Ph.D. at Princeton intending to teach, and did briefly. I taught at Michigan State University for a year and the University of Toronto for a year and a half, at which point I got an opportunity to go to Washington and work on the Senate staff, which I did. At the end of 3 years there, I called my friend Bill Buckley and said, Bill, you need a Washington editor of National Review. And Bill essentially said, you're right, I do, and you're it. About how hard it was. Bill had a wonderful penchant for spotting young people he took an interest in and giving them jobs.
I sort of see you as picking up that flag as what I might consider the intellectual conservative, I won't say movement, but as an intellectual conservative. And would you agree with that?
Yes. My life's work has been to make conservatism intellectually respectable and politically palatable.
I want to go back because I'm curious about whether those Midwestern roots have anything to do with how you view the world. I've heard other people say growing up in the Midwest gives you a worldview perhaps or maybe just a national view that might be a little different than growing up in the East Coast or the West Coast.
I think that's probably true. I grew up in what today is called flyover country. That people going from one coast to another look down upon us in several senses. But I do think growing up in the Midwest, you do have an appreciation of the sturdy, rooted common sense of the American people, who are not extreme, but they're not silly.
Another Midwesterner that you know, because it goes back to the Goldwater days, Phyllis Schlafly from Alton. You're going to Washington University, where she received an honorary degree and really created quite a storm of protest. how do you walk into Washington University today, knowing that that's the kind of reception that Phyllis Schlafly got, although she did get the honorary degree?
Well, I've spoken there before. I gave the commencement address and got an honorary degree, and everyone was exquisitely polite, and I don't think because they were suppressing furies. I've not had problems on campuses before. I have an honorary degree from Duke, which is not a nest of conservatives, I assure you. Phyllis Schlafly is a remarkable woman who single-handedly stopped, and wisely, in my judgment, the Equal Rights Amendment.
Yeah, you got to give credit where credit is due, whether you agree with her or not. And she was the author of the Goldwater book, am I right? Choice, Not an Echo?
So, yes, she was. I'm not sure the title, but I know she was an early and avid Goldwater supporter. As I cast my first presidential vote, first time I was over 21, which you had to be back in my ancient history, I cast my first vote for Goldwater. We were a plucky group, 27 million of us.
We're talking to George Will. This is Jim Kircher filling in for Don Marsh this morning. You can join the conversation at 382-8255, 382-TALK. We've got a call from Jay. He's calling from Normandy. Jay, you got a question you want to get in on this?
Yes, sir. Hi, guys. Mr. Will, I saw you at Principia College a while back, but I wanted to get your comments. I ask you the same question, but things have accelerated quite a bit more. I'm looking at Bloomberg Business News. Headline of the cover: it's global warming stupid. That the mayor and governors of states in the east. I heard the former mayor of Malibu talking about sea level rise. I'm looking at Popular Science, hardly a liberal magazine, talking about devoting a whole issue. Climate change is already happening. You know, I suggest you might want to take a look at our Mississippi River, one of the lowest drought stages that we've ever had. And new reports in the past 2 weeks have said that CO2 is at its highest level ever, and that global warming in every phase that they talk about. And 97% of scientists say that man is involved in global warming, and it's going on.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and get the let's go ahead and get the response.
Well, there wasn't a question there, but I think he wants to say, I'm often asked, why don't you believe in climate change? I do believe in climate change. It's the only thing we all, on both sides of this argument, know for sure is that the climate is changing, because it always is, and that's sort of the point. The climate has changed a lot since Greenland was named Greenland because it was so warm, people cultivated Greenland. The climate has changed since the time when the mini ice age of the Middle Ages, when the Thames River was frozen 3 feet thick and fairs were held on the frozen river.
But the question becomes man-made influence
now,
on this.
Let me give you just one example. I remember in the 1970s when there was an enormous number of articles and scientific studies about global cooling that we had to worry about. Well, that didn't work out, and you say, well, gee, what happened? They said, well, we got our models wrong. Well, that's fine. These models are complicated. Climate science is an enormous number of variables. The question is, do we have enough certainty today that we ought to make decisions involving trillions of dollars of either transfers of wealth or foregone wealth creation based on models which 30 years ago turned out to be not true?
Second,
I own a home on Kiawah Island, South Carolina, facing southeast hurricane country. And I remember when Katrina struck New Orleans, a Category 3 hurricane, people said, that proves it. Katrina is evidence of climate change, global warming, and we're going to have, Al Gore and other people said this, we're going to have a spate. This is the future. Increasing frequency. Since then, we've had the fewest strong Category 3 or more hurricanes than at any time since accurate records began being kept in the 1850s.
So you're not convinced.
I'm not convinced.
What would it take to convince you?
Well, for example, people say, gee, the drought on the Mississippi, and we are indeed having a drought in the United States. So it seemed to me a sensible person asked, gosh, that's interesting. Is it worse than the drought that produced, say, the Dust Bowl in the 1930s? And if not, are we to say, what caused the Dust Bowl in the 1930s? I mean, is every severe climate event a product of man-made global climate change? If not, let's quit piggybacking our political agendas onto every weather development.
We've got a lot of calls lining up, as I thought we might. We're talking to columnist George Will. He's speaking at Washington University at 7 o'clock at Graham Chapel tonight. This is St. Louis on the Air on KWMU 90.7, St. Louis Public Radio. And we're back. This is Jim Kircher filling in for Don March this morning. Our guest is columnist George Will, who will be speaking at Washington University at Graham Chapel. We're going to take a call from Brant in St. Louis. Brant, are you there?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Thank you. I'm a fiscal moderate and a social conservative, but I think that the thing that the Republicans have done poorly is welcoming immigrants. I think immigrants should be natural-born conservatives because they come here to get away from tyranny. And now we have what appears to be more of a like socialism coming. I'm not saying we're fully there yet, but looks like we're on that way.
Well, let's talk about the immigration issue. It's something that under George W. Bush, immigration reform was attempted. John McCain was part of that. It dropped off the radar screen for Republicans. Nobody touched it. And now, after the election, the Achieve Act comes up as a possibility, a Republican version, if I could say, of the Dream Act, or a new version of the Dream Act. And people are talking about immigration reform. But let's go what the caller says. Are the Republicans missing the boat here? Is this something that this country needs to deal with, Republicans and Democrats?
Both parties are missing the boat. Actually, one of the few things in Washington where there's a broad consensus, and the House acted on it last week, was that it is madness to bring here educated and about to be educated immigrants who take the STEM courses, science, technology, engineering, mathematics. They get a degree, and then we equip them. Having equipped them to add value in a modern economy, we send them away. It's madness, and they've increased by 55,000 the visas for people like that to stay here. But beyond that.
Well, there's something called that's been referred to the Staple Law or the Staple Act, where you get the PhD and you get your green card stapled to it. Is that maybe overreaching, or is
no? I don't think so. I mean, I have a very libertarian view on immigration. I think first we need immigrants. We know how to stop immigration. We just did it. For the last 2 years, there has been net out migration of Hispanics because we had a great recession. You want to stop immigration? Have a recession. Most immigrants come here to better themselves. Immigration is a fundamentally entrepreneurial act. It's risk-taking to better yourself and your family.
And I want to distinguish between illegal immigration and legal immigration, because is legal immigration down as well, or is it the illegal immigration that is going down?
Yes, net out-migration of Hispanics. Now, the big policy question is what to do with the 11 million or so illegal immigrants who are here. The beginning of wisdom is this. You know, I did the arithmetic. In order to deport 11 million immigrants would require a line of buses bumper to bumper extending from San Diego to Alaska. It's not going to happen. 5 million of these people are in the workforce. We need them. We have an aging population. We need immigration to replenish our workforce. Otherwise, we can't fund the entitlement welfare state that we have. So there's a sense in which, both for the health of the economy and for the health of the welfare state, immigration is not optional. We have to have it.
The argument, though, is that this is a nation of laws. We can't allow people to come in legally and illegally and reward them by letting them stay. How do we deal with that particular issue of the laws rectifying this? The word amnesty is something that nobody can hardly use anymore. In terms of that.
I'll use it. You respond to it with amnesty.
But you're not running for election.
I understand that, but I know the arguments against it. We had amnesty under Ronald Reagan, and it solved nothing under the Simpson-Mazzoli bill. The fact is the American people, they may clamor for law and order, but they would not tolerate, nor should they, the police measures that would be necessary to extract from our communities 11 million illegal immigrants, a substantial portion of whom have been here 10 years or more. They are part of the fabric of our communities. They've had 5 million children who, born here, are automatically American citizens. Now, deporting American citizens just because you're deporting their parents is a pretty severe measure from which I think the American people in their native goodness would flinch. When's the last time we've had a government-driven migration anywhere in the world of 11 million people without concentration camps? Think about this. I mean, we're talking about an enormous police and social engineering measure that when you think about it, you think that there's got to be a better way to handle this.
Let's take another call. This is from Jerry. He's calling from O'Fallon. Jerry, go ahead.
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I was well aware that you're from Champaign-Urbana area because I ran into you on an Ozark Airlines flight about 30 years ago. But I don't think either party talks about, we were very good after World War II at creating jobs, careers, high-paying jobs for the average individual. And I grew up in a middle-class, lower-middle-class suburb here in St. Louis. Most of the people worked on the assembly line at Ford or GM, or at that time just McDonnell Aircraft. These people made good wages. They bought homes. They bought boats. There was a tremendous multiplier effect to the money that they received that went back essentially into the economy. And if there's anything I could put my finger on in the last decade, I realize this make this very brief, is that we really don't have, for someone getting out of high school with a high school degree, maybe even a couple of years of junior college or something, it's a fantasy to think that you are going to stay in a job or even secure a job that would allow you to have what we used to call the kind of a normal life. And I know the world marketplace has changed a lot of things, but if you look back in the past, and I'm talking about conservatives who were 40, 50, 60 years ago, businesses were run, yes, to benefit the stockholders, but also they considered the employees, they considered their communities, and I think it's very simplistic. There's a lot of factors in that, but to me, that seems the change that has brought about our biggest economic changes.
Okay, a lot of points there.
Well, it is easy to have nostalgia for the post-war period, 1950s, 40s, 50s, into the early 60s. Paul Krugman's made a career out of 50s nostalgia. The problem is this. One of the main reasons why the United States boomed after the war was, A, the war had caused us to build an enormous manufacturing base that was not destroyed, and B, our industrial competitors were in ruins, Europe, Japan, Germany, etc. You could have, for example, the automobile industry, enormous pent-up demand at the end of the Second World War for automobiles. And the United Auto Workers could be militant and could demand substantial concessions from management, and management could give them because it had nothing to fear. There was no competition. Globalization was a word not yet invented because the phenomenon that it denotes was not yet born. The world is different, hopelessly so, and we saw what happened with the United Auto Workers and Detroit when the American people were given by globalization a choice in the products they could buy. Detroit had gotten complacent, fat, and shoddy in their products. People said, well, I'll just buy a little thing, odd-looking car called a Beetle. I'll buy a Volkswagen, or I'll buy a Toyota or a Honda made in Ohio. And the market worked, and the conditions about which people are so nostalgic in the 1940s and 50s, the post-war prosperity, was wonderful and also doomed and finally irrecoverable.
One of the things he brought up was educational issues. And there, as he was talking about that, there was a broader question in my mind that I think you could probably talk about, and that's just really America's competitiveness. I don't mean business competitiveness necessarily on the surface, but just its role in the world as a leader in so many areas. Is that threatened? Is it declining? Is it as healthy as ever?
It's threatened because the world is a more competitive place, but
Competitive people. We ought to be able to step in and deal with this, right?
I think we are stepping in and dealing with it. The fact is, the Nobel Prizes are still won by Americans disproportionately. The patents issued are disproportionately those by Americans. 8 of the 10 globally highest-ranked universities, research universities, are American. Of the top 100 universities in the world, about half are American research universities. Our higher education system is the envy of the world. I don't despair about this. Manufacturing, people say, oh, gosh, American manufacturing's down. Actually, American manufacturing depends partly on how you calibrate it. We're either number one or number two. people say yes, but the number of people employed in manufacturing is a third of what it was, say, 40 years ago. Yes, that's a good thing because we have enormously more productive manufacturing workforce. So it's, again, the glass is half full, not half empty.
I want to go back to global warming for a minute, too, because you mentioned our incredible achievements scientifically. And yet there is a sense among – for some folks that Republicans, conservatives, Christian conservatives are anti-science. So go ahead. You've chuckled. You know, because a lot of people, as the caller earlier said, well, here's what the scientists are saying. And you're saying, I'm not convinced yet.
Well, wait a minute. The scientist, definite article, that there is no dissent. That's simply not true. I can get you a list of hundreds of fully credentialed – climate scientists who are to one degree or another skeptical of the certitude with which certain climate scientists voice their opinions. Second, let's be realistic. There is a sociology of science, and the grants and rewards and peer reviews tend to be at the moment skewed toward those who tend to confirm the prevailing hypothesis about climate change. Again, no one doubts that there is climate change. The question is the extent to which this can be called man-driven. And I can tell you that the policy question is how much money do we want to spend on climate change in order to have no discernible effect on climate change? I mean, it's all very well for people to buy their Priuses. And I've got a bottle of water here, plastic bottle, and it says on the bottle, smaller cap equals less plastic. And as something on the label says, the cap is using 20% less plastic. That's fine. I'm all for don't use any more plastic than you have to. But let's not kid ourselves. Let's not pretend. It makes us feel good. But feeling good isn't the purpose of public policy.
It's an interesting country, though, that I've always said this, that, you know, it is a very religious country. It's a very scientific country. It's a place if you want a heart-lung transplant, this is probably the place to be. And yet we also argue about whether we should teach evolution. I'm not arguing for or against that. I just find that to be a fascinating country and why a lot of Europeans, I would think, don't quite understand us. I'm not sure we understand us, but there is it's just an interesting irony, perhaps.
My worry about being understood by Europeans ranks pretty low on my list of worries. I don't think there's really – America's not convulsed over the issue of evolution.
Gets a lot of coverage, though.
Now, who's covering it? And a lot of this coverage, one can, if you listen not very carefully, hear the grinding of political axes.
Somebody mentioned the – you know, I was listening and he said a fiscal moderate, a social conservative. Let me go back to just a broader view of conservatism. There's cultural conservatism, social conservative, political conservative, fiscal conservative. When you say conservative in terms of an ideology or a philosophy, are we talking all of those things?
I'm pick and choose. We're cafeteria conservatives, not all liberals agree with a liberal agenda. There isn't the conservative agenda. Conservatism begins with individualism. It begins with something I'll be talking about tonight at the John C. Danforth Center. It begins with the doctrine of natural rights, which the Declaration makes as the basis of limited government. That's the beginning and the core of conservatism. There are other filigrees on the doctrine, but all conservatives, it seems to me, share that.
Our guest is columnist George Will. He will be speaking at Washington University's Graham Chapel on religion and politics in the first modern nation. I'm Jim Kircher filling in for Don Marsh today. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And we're back with columnist George Will. I just asked him during the break whether he's ever going to retire, and the answer is?
I propose to file a column on my 90th birthday.
There you go. How old are you now?
I'm 71. And enjoy what I'm doing.
Yeah, and there's the topics, the issues never really go away, right?
The news, it
keeps coming back.
It's amazingly fertile. I keep making more news.
Well, I know you may actually get more argument on this topic than anything else. Let's talk baseball a little bit because you're a huge baseball fan and have written quite a bit. Marvin Miller, the Baseball Players Union president, just passed away. I think it was Red Barber said the three most important people in the history of baseball were Babe Ruth and Jackie Robinson and Marvin Miller.
True.
Changed everything.
True, absolutely, and changed for the better. Until Marvin Miller came along and with the help of a mediator called Peter Seitz overthrew the reserve clause, thereby bringing about free agency, Major League Baseball players did not have the elementary right to negotiate terms of employment with the employer of their choice. Now, Marvin Miller was a very shrewd man who, once they struck down the reserve clause, and Charlie Finley, then in Kansas City, said, well, okay, let's make them all free agents. Marvin Miller said, not so fast. Let's have a six-year wait before you can be 6 years of service time before you can be a free agent, because he didn't want to flood the market with free agents. Supply, oversupply would have driven down demand and price. So he engineered prosperity. The owners, who were at that point in baseball's history, were almost always wrong about almost everything, said this is the end of competitive balance, whereas in fact that's when such competitive balance as we have, which is flawed but much better, really began. The Yankee, Giants, Dodgers quit being the story of Major League Baseball.
Yet I grew up in a time, I grew up as a Cubs fan. Ernie Banks spent his entire career with the Cubs, Billy Williams, Ron Santo. And yet the kids in St. Louis had to see Albert Pujols go somewhere else for a huge amount of money. Doesn't that in itself, in a previous area, certainly Stan Musial, but doesn't that in itself change how people view baseball?
No. That's what Albert Pujols did. There's a name for that. It's called freedom. He had the freedom to choose and to move, and we want that. That's a good thing. Freedom, let's not lose that. Freedom's a good thing. Tony Gwynn in our era, Cal Ripken in our era, Chipper Jones, who acquired last year in our era, spent all their careers with the San Diego Padres, Baltimore Orioles, and Atlanta Braves. There are still career players. David Wright is going to retire a New York Met. We saw that just from the new contract he got. So there's the fact that there is today player mobility does not indicate that there won't still be career Cardinals and career Cubs. Furthermore, there was a lot of churning of rosters before the reserve clause was struck down. It was just that the players had no say in it. They were shipped around like property.
Let's talk about the Hall of Fame, Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, Sammy Sosa coming up for inclusion, coming out of the steroid era. Everybody's got an opinion on this, I guess. So what's yours?
My opinion is that if you cheated, if you made a mockery of the record book, which Barry Bonds did, to just take one person, you should not be in the Hall of Fame. The Hall of Fame ballot has a character clause. And if you take it seriously, sportsmanship, character, integrity, you vote against him on those grounds. A practical matter. It's very important to the Hall of Fame in that sweet little village of Cooperstown, that the old members of the Hall of Fame keep coming back. It's part of the great ceremony in August on the induction weekend when the new members are admitted. If you admit Barry Bonds or Clemens or Sosa, Frank Robinson's never coming back. Whole bunch of the old-timers who are understandably and justifiably bitter. I mean, imagine you're Frank Robinson. You hit 570-some home runs, and you see Sammy Sosa shoot by you and Barry Bonds shoot by you, and you know they're cheating. You'd be darn better if the Hall of Fame says, well, what the heck? What difference does it make? It makes a difference.
Now, some of the sports writers who will be voting have said, well, if you had a Hall of Fame career before the steroid era and then it took off during, then maybe I'll vote you in.
Well, they can split that hair if they wish.
What about Pete Rose? Same question, same issue.
Pete Rose walked in and out of clubhouses at least 25,000 times in his career, and every time he walked by a billboard, and on that billboard were certain rules, and in bold print in those rules, it said the penalty for betting on baseball is permanent expulsion. Now, Major League Baseball can say one of two things. Either Pete Rose didn't do it. That ceased being untenable when in his second autobiography, and I'm not sure he read it, but in his second autobiography, Pete Rose said he did it. Or baseball can say it doesn't matter. Well, gambling on baseball is the scarlet sin because of baseball's institutional memory of the Black Sox scandal of 1919 when the White Sox threw the World Series to the Cincinnati Reds. Does matter. Pete Rose is flagrantly guilty and completely unrepentant. He wished he hadn't been caught, but aside from that, he's unrepentant. And if the rule means anything at all, he's a poster child for why the rule should be honored.
Tell me personally, what's your – I guess first question is growing up in Champaign-Urbana, did you come to St. Louis for ball games or did you go to Chicago for ball games?
I went to Chicago. I came to Old Sportsman's Park once to see the Cardinals in that marvelous little bandbox. And I guess I've been to Major League Baseball games in three ballparks in St. Louis and three in Pittsburgh. But so, yeah, I did come here just once. Sam Jones pitched for the Cubs.
It does have – let me just talk, you know, sort of lovingly. Baseball still – it's still alive. It is still. It may not be the TV product that football is, but it still has a very special place in defining America, doesn't it?
Well, the product on the field is better than ever, in part because we've, just as in 1947, baseball opened itself to the enormous reservoir of African American talent. Baseball in the last 20 years has found a way to tap the enormous reservoir of Hispanic talent and Asian talent. So the product on the field is good. The fans are responding. The turnstiles are humming as never before. Let me give you a fabulously interesting statistic. 1955, the Brooklyn Dodgers win the World Series. Ferrillo, Snyder, Campanella, Robinson, Don Newcomb. Wonderful team. Everyone says, oh, gosh, isn't it tragedy. They left Brooklyn and went to California. In 1955, Brooklyn wins with this great team. Average attendance was 13,000 a year. 13,000. Much worse than the worst attendance in Major League Baseball nowadays.
Yeah, that sounds like Miami.
Yeah, but Miami does much better than that.
Right.
The fact is, in the so-called golden era of baseball, people weren't going to the games the way they are today.
We're going to go back to politics. We got an email. Republican primary process. Did this process play a role in Mr. Romney's loss in the national election? Does Mr. Will think the Republican Party will change the process of nomination before the next presidential election?
That's an excellent question. I think the primary process of 2011-12 prefigured this outcome, but it prefigured it in the sense that we saw how long it took Mitt Romney to surmount a singularly weak set of opponents. Herman Cain, Michelle Bachmann, Newt Gingrich, et cetera, et cetera. I think the party will try to assert itself a bit so that we don't have 20 debates, which are occasions for a bidding up of the auctioning process that's part of politics. So I think they'll try to change that by 2012. And it would be nice, I don't know how you do this, but it would be nice if there were some institutional filter that could keep certain kinds of candidates, Herman Cain comes to mind, off the stage.
Why is that?
Well, because Herman Cain this was an exercise in self-promotion. The man had no discernible qualification for the job of chief executive. There was zero chance that he was going to be nominated, and less than zero chance, if that were mathematically possible, of being elected.
Susan is calling. Susan, you're calling from Illinois, somewhere in Illinois.
So,
go ahead.
Yes, hello. I have a three-part question.
Oh,
if I may.
Let's make it two parts.
Okay. Okay, I'm wondering what your religious orientation may be. And are you aware that in the state of Illinois, the Catholic Church is no longer handling adoptions? You can sort of develop that question, what's going on in that. Are you aware of that?
I'm not aware of that. My religious affiliation is I have none.
Okay.
I'm
well,
what
let me
is
ask
called unchurched.
Okay, let's go to the third question.
Okay, and that is, okay, the federal government is going to require employers to provide certain services that some institutions, religious possibly, do not wish to provide. So how do you react to that?
I think it's an appalling development. I think it's part of the agenda of a certain political persuasion in this country to break more and more of the intermediary institutions of civil society to the saddle of the state. I think it is a clear violation of the spirit and perhaps the letter of the First Amendment, which protects the free exercise of religion. And I think when, for example, Georgetown University or Catholic institutions are required to provide services that go against church teaching, that this is a violation of their constitutional right to the free exercise of religion.
So what's the answer? How do we deal with this particular issue? Is it just to get out of that?
Don't require them to violate their conscience. It's not complicated. It's not as though this has been a 200-year practice. This is a novelty introduced by the Obama administration. Go back to the last 230-some years of American history.
I'm going to go ahead and take another call. We'll go back to baseball. Mike is calling from St. Louis. Mike, go ahead.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions. One is concerning the absence of black ball players. You know, this generic answer everybody giving is not really being taken seriously. I've heard other major league players such as Torrey Hunter address it, or CeCe Sabathian, and they got to the root of it. The scouts just don't want to come into the community because there are kids that can play baseball. Second, I don't understand why isn't being exposed the fact that most of the steroid stuff is being taken by these Hispanic players. They say it's part of the culture from A-Rod on down. And third is, want somebody to talk about La Russa concerning when Ron Gant and some other black ball players here called this man a racist, and it was just kind of just pushed up under the door. Thank you.
Hey, Mike, are you still there, Mike? I was just wondering if kids in his neighborhood were playing baseball to the extent that they were, say, when I was a kid. I think that's a question.
Let me take these issues.
Go ahead. One at a time.
I know Tony La Russa very well.
Right.
Wrote a book about him, consider him a friend, at dinner with him not long ago. There isn't a racist fiber in his body. And I've never heard a black player who played for him complain about this. Second, the question of the declining number of African Americans in baseball has some – there are a lot of factors here. One is, you know, want to play basketball, you get a court and a net. And you go to it. Baseball requires fields and tending the fields and a kind of coaching that basketball doesn't always require. And I'm going to be blunt here, it requires fathers. And we have enough family disintegration all through America, but particularly in the African-American community, where 74% of children are born to unmarried women. There's a father problem that
somebody's got to pitch the ball. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Beyond this, baseball now, young kids who show talent get on what are called travel teams. And the equipment's expensive and the travel is expensive, and it tends to favor more affluent children from more affluent families, which is a handicap.
You know, I remember, and again, I'm talking about when I was a kid, our default thing to do was play ball in the street.
Yeah.
We didn't play basketball.
We played baseball in Champaign, Illinois, and vacant lots. The lots aren't vacant anymore. Things like that. I mean, baseball grew up an urban game. It's hard for people to realize, but Joe DiMaggio was from San Francisco. Whitey Ford from New York City. There's less of that now.
Dan is calling in from Kirkwood. Dan, go ahead.
Yes. It's a pleasure to be with Mr. Will. And my question has to do with the economic disparity in this country. And I've traveled quite a bit around Latin America, and I've been to India. And I'm getting the feeling that the United States has become almost second world, not really third world. But would Mr. Will, or someone who is high-powered and is usually on the morning roundtables on Sundays, be willing to take Cory Booker's challenge? You know, I'm talking about the mayor of Newark, and live on $30, is it a month? Of food stamps. I think that would be pretty interesting, because I think that we're almost denying the amount of poor people we have in the United States of America right now.
Well, clearly the stagnation of middle-class incomes is a huge problem. I do not think the answer is to increase food stamp participation. 47 million people on food stamps is not a sign of national health and not a real measure of serious compassion in public policy. I do think that that's probably the foremost problem confronting this country. There's a new report out that says median middle-class income today is at 1969 level. Think that that's not a lost decade. That's four decades lost. That's partly because middle-class families in the housing crisis lost 18% of their net worth, with astonishing consequences on the recovery. The American economy, when it's humming, is 70% personal consumption, most of it by the middle class, which is where most of the money is in this country. And until the American middle class feels and is, and they're almost two different things, but feels and is prosperous again and is out from under the overhang of borrowing and debt, the recovery is going to be slow, and the income stagnation will continue, and the widening disparities of income will continue.
That's certainly been one of the issues in the politics, is the income disparity. Talk about the whether you're talking about the 47% or the 99% or the 1% or over $250,000. We've got a lot of politics using these issues, addressing these issues, but I wonder if they're really addressing the issues, or do you think they're just sort of using them?
Well, it's not easy. I mean, great problems are great problems because they're difficult to know what caused them, and it's difficult to know how to solve them. I mean, politics is a blunt instrument. I mentioned a moment ago the family disintegration in this country. We don't know what caused it. The out-of-wedlock birth rate in this country in 1950 was 5%. Today it's 33%, one in three American children, all races, all ethnicities. Now, we've seen family disintegration at various times in history as a result of war, famine, plague. This happened in peace and prosperity, and it didn't just happen in the United States. It happened in Wales, Scotland, Portugal. No one knows why. Until you know why, you can't begin to fashion solutions. And the same is true to a considerable extent with the income disparities.
You've studied a lot of history. One of the things that I think people don't get is that history doesn't go along in a steady line, that things come and they go. People look back to the 50s and think that was the standard. And it may have been the standard several times before that, but it wasn't a continuation of something. These things come and go. Does that give you a sense of you've talked a little bit about the hope for the United States?
When I'm dictator of the world, the only permissible college major is going to be history. I am so tired of every generation having to reinvent the wheel and rediscover the Declaration of Independence and all the rest. I mean, if we could just give people a sense of the complexities of life and the fact that some of our problems are unique and a lot of them aren't, that there's an enormous historical memory in the human race, we'd be a lot better off.
George Will, thanks so much for joining us. I hate to leave so many callers hanging on. Mr. Will be speaking at Washington University's John C. Danforth Center on Religion and Politics, in the First Modern Nation. That's at Washington University's Graham Chapel. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we're going to be talking about a new exhibit at the St. Louis Holocaust Museum and the lessons the world has not yet learned. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. I'm Jim Kircher.